Jewish audio on Chabad.org.
Today we are going to continue and Bezrat Hashem conclude the Gemara on side A of page Yud Aleph. Thank you. So the last Gemara we learned about was about, we're expounding the words that says, Hu Achashverosh, right? We said, Hu. So we said, Hu, he was evil, mitchilasi v'atzeifei, from beginning to the end. And then the Gemara brought a number of examples of people who, it says, Hu also. And the Gemara said, yeah, that's right, it doesn't have to be bad. It could be Hu, could mean in a good way, Hu could mean in a bad way. So we explained Vayihi Bimei, we explained. Hu Achashverosh, we explained. What are we up to next? What's the next word in the Megillah? Vayihi Bimei Achashverosh, Hu Achashverosh. So far we did the first six words. What comes now? Hamoylech. Hamoylech. We're going to talk about Achashverosh's reign now. Achashverosh's rise to power and his subsequent reign. Let's do this one more time. Daf Yud Aleph Amud Aleph. Page 11. Side A. Probably 4 if you're using the art scroll version. Says the Gemara, Hamoylech. With regard to the words Hamoylech. Hamoylech literally translates as who ruled. Omar. So Rav, the great sage of Bavel, says about the word Hamoylech. It doesn't say Hamelech. It doesn't say that he was appointed as king. It's Hamoylech who ruled. So Rav said, this means Shemolach Mayatzmei, that Achashverosh took the throne all by himself. What does it mean he took the throne all by itself? Every king takes the throne by himself. I mean, like every person. So you can't self-appoint. You have to get people to follow you.
By force.
By force? Who? How did he have a force? So Rashi says the meaning of Shemelech Ma'atzmi means Shalehoya Mizera Hamalucha, that he did not come from royal progeny. So usually, people who occupy positions like that inherited a position. So they have it, therefore, by virtue of pedigree. Because they have lineage, because they got so and such and such inherited from the generation before, that's how they're able to be successful. Like the famous story, they say that somebody is lucky that his father was born before him. There's a famous Litvish of art that said the yichus means lineage, fine pedigree. So yichus is like a zero. It's like a zero. It's worthless. But if you put something in front of it, then it's worth something. Right? So you have, depending on how many zeros are very nice. If you put a 1, a 2, a 3, a 4, depending on what you put in front of it, so then it develops into something. So yichus could be something if you're somewhat capable yourself. But otherwise, we have a situation of nepotism, which for absolutely no reason, I'm going to tell you where that word comes from. It comes from the word nepo in Italian, which means nephew, because the popes did not have children, or so it was said. So they would try to push their nephews into the position. And because oftentimes the nephews did not have the same abilities and gifts that they had, the only thing they had was that they were a nephew or relative. So this is where the terminology nepotism came from. Nepotism is a very bad idea. However, if somebody is born into a particular family that has certain gifts and strengths, and he develops those strengths or she develops those strengths by themselves, there's nothing wrong with that. You don't have to come fall off a tree. It's okay to have nice parents. It's okay to come from somewhere. It's not a sin. But when it comes to royalty, there are many, many rabbanim, or many great chachamim amongst the Jewish people, whose position is rightfully inherited by the children.
Yes.
It's al pi halacha like that.
But
as a rule, with Jewish people, if you don't have what to sell, you ain't going to succeed. Especially even in the realm of Torah. Maybe the realm of politics. In the realm of Torah, either you have what to sell or you don't have what to sell. So a person who came from a nice background but does not have any content of his own will not succeed in the world of Torah. You cannot be a Rosh Hashiva or a Rav and you be an Am Ha'aretz, you be an ignoramus. It's not going to work. What are you going to say? What are you going to sell? Okay. But it is also true that it makes sense that children have the gifts of their parents. or sometimes even more so. So if you had somebody who's extraordinarily talented, it's very likely that they will have extraordinarily talented children. It's likely that they married somebody talented, and then the meiosis of two different people who got married, and then they created a new child, that child may take all of the wonderful qualities of both parents. There's a famous Rav who had a very large nose, and he's very brilliant. And his wife had a very nice nose, but she was not so smart. And he said, I hoped that my son would take my wife's nose and my head. My brain. But he said, alas, it was not meant to be so. Oftentimes, the truly great Chachamim had a line that followed them. Hillel HaZaken, right? Seventh generation is Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. So we see there's a dynastic line. And there were many, many other examples of this, where there was dynasties amongst the Jewish people. Eventually, no dynasty lasts forever, but there are many dynasties that lasted for a very long time. Right? The Rebbe of Lubavitch was a dynasty. It was a dynastic thing. Okay.
It starts somewhere.
Everything starts somewhere.
So the first one...
Every Yid is a Ben Melech.
No,
the first one of the chain, actually, at least in ancient times, was chosen. Shaul HaMelech is chosen by the hand of Hashem. David HaMelech is chosen by the Navi. Hashem chooses him. Anyway, we're really all over the place. Let's get back to the Gemara. So the Gemara... The Gemara says that he's Malach Ma'atzme, and Rashi explained, what does it mean, Malach Ma'atzme, says Rashi? Rashi says it means he had no claim to the throne. He had no claim. He did not come from any kind of royal background. Lehoya Mizera Hamlucha. It wasn't natural. It wasn't intuitive. Nobody predicted that this person will someday become the king, the ruler of the ancient Persian Empire. Now, that's a matter of fact. And that says something. It says a lot about Ahasuerus. Because a person who falls into the lap of importance or power or luxury, okay, they fell into that. It's called born with a silver spoon. But the person who comes to it by themselves, it's impressive. It's impressive. You can't, that's a sign of real talent. That's a sign of real wherewithal, of real ability, if somebody doesn't have that push, that extra background or that extra foundation to build upon. So this is the Gemara says, now that we know something about Ahasuerus, it is thought that he was a fool. That's the common misnomer. But there's no way he could have been a fool. Maybe a maniac, but not a fool. A megalomaniac, an egomaniac, a narcissist, I'll grant you, a sex maniac, all those things, yes. But a fool would never be able to accomplish what he accomplished. He had to be extraordinarily talented. He came out of nowhere, and he became the mightiest man in the world. So the Gemara says... that Amri Lo, there are those who said that this should be understood l'shvach, that this is a praise, this is something to be impressed with. V'Amri Lo, and others suggested that this was l'gnai, this was something which was a disgrace, a demerit, not something to be impressed with or something to write home about. All right, what is the reason? Why Amri Lo l'shvach? Some those who say that this sings the praises of Ahasuerus and proves to you what an extraordinarily talented person he was and what a gifted politician and how able this individual was. Because if this guy could rise to the top, what does it tell you? It tells you he was unparalleled because if somebody else was more talented or more capable, he would have taken the position. And you have a king who rises to power because he comes from kings. So why did he rise and not somebody else rise? Or why did this queen rise and not another woman rise? Very simple. Because this man or this woman is a prince or a princess. So that's why they rose. So there are a number of things which caused their rise to power. You will say, indeed, there were another 9 princes that were vying for the throne. True. So he was the most capable of the 9 princes. But he's not the most capable person in his environment, not the most capable person in that civilization. Because, so why, if he wasn't the most capable, why didn't the most capable person get the position? What's the simple answer? Because he had the natural dibs. He came from that kind of background. But when the person has no head start, and does not receive any assistance, and doesn't have anything to build on, and yet he succeeds, that tells you he's the most extraordinary person, most talented individual in that arena that existed at the time. But Amri lo lignai, so the truth is, that's very impressive. There is nobody could say that's not impressive. That is impressive. But the question is, though, when we say Hamoylech, when the Megillah conveys the word Hamoylech to us, is it important for us to know that he was the most talented person or not the most talented person? Of what relevance of that? That's really what this argument is about. Is the Megillah telling us, is singing Ahasuerus' praises, or is the Megillah trying to denigrate Ahasuerus? So those who said yes, to sing his praises, to tell you who this person is, how capable he was. V'amri lo lignai, and others suggest that the Megillah is not trying to spin a positive light or put Ahasuerus in a positive light or spin him in a positive fashion. The lahavi chazi l'malchusa, that he was not worthy of being a royal. He was not worthy of being a regent. Well, how did he do it then? What did he have that nobody else had? Says the Gemara, Mamayna Yaseirahu de Yahiv. He just had a lot of money. He was willing to spend the fortune. He wasn't royal, but a fortune he had. So because he was royal, he was ready to spend a fortune. That's why he rose to the top. In other words, there has to be something propelling a person to rise to the top. Either it's lineage, it's connections, it's wealth. There's got to be something. Why this person, not other people? If that person is the most gifted person, that's the reason. Nobody is more articulate. Nobody is more dynamic. Nobody is more creative. Nobody is more of a visionary. Nobody is more intuitive. That's a good reason. Those are all qualities that are needed for a leader. And this person has all those qualities. He's articulate and he's intuitive and he has vision and he is politically savvy. And he has strength, and he has charisma. Okay, yeah, you know, that's why he rose to the top. Had there been other people who could rival that, they would have risen to the top. Or unless we say that, but listen, he came from a royal background. And then we could say a person doesn't come from a royal background. So then what did he do? He wasn't the smartest, he wasn't the most talented, he wasn't the most capable. So how did he do it? What's the answer? He had $1 billion, that's the answer. He bought it. It doesn't mean he's not capable at all. It doesn't mean he couldn't do anything. He could do a lot of things. But is he the most articulate and the greatest visionary and the most charisma? Absolutely not. So why did he rise? Money. So that's the thing. Ahasuerus, we know, did not have any lineage. That we know for sure. So what did he have? Either it was because of his wherewithal, or it was because of his money. The truth is he did have money. Nobody argues about this. He did have the money. And nobody argues that he did not come from a royal background. The question is, what do we emphasize here? We're trying to emphasize his gifts, his talents, his abilities that propelled him to the top. Or do we try to emphasize that he's propelled to the top because of another natural reason? The natural reason is usually the lineage or where he came from. He doesn't have that. So what's the natural reason? The natural reason was he bought it. All right. So we know a lot of things about Ahasuerus now, by the way. From that one word, Hamoylech, we know, number one, how he came to the throne. We do know that he was a very capable person, no question. He was nobody's fool. We also know that he was a person who was very wealthy. Yeah, he marries royalty, but you don't become a king for marrying royalty. Had Vashti been queen and he would have married her, then he would be, I don't know, regent, consort in chief, I don't know what you call him, but he wouldn't be the king. He was the king. He cemented his position by marrying royalty, the great-granddaughter of Ahasuerus, the daughter of Belshazzar, the daughter of Merodach, the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. He cemented it. He married into the Kennedys. But he himself was a powerful individual. So that's the business, the Gemara is expounding on the word Hamoylech. What's the next words now? Hamoylech. The next words are Hamoylech ruled. Now we get some geography. Hamoylech mehodu v'ad Kush, who ruled from Hodu until Kush. Now, before we go into the next piece of Gemara, I would like to make an admission. I do not claim to fully understand what the Gemara is going to say now. I'm just telling you. Because it seems that the countries that we're talking about here are not in dispute. It seems the countries, we know where these countries are. The question then is, what is the Gemara arguing about? And I will share with you a number of different explanations of the Mefarshim, but I'm just going to tell you, personally, it doesn't resonate. It's my shortcoming. I don't understand this Gemara fully. Now, Hodu is, by any admission, by any yardstick, is referring to India. I actually researched, I did not find any other country that was ever referred to by the name of Hodu other than India. And there is actually a city in northern India which is called Hodu, which doesn't mean anything. It just means a place happened to be called Hodu. But Hodu is understood to be the Hebrew reference to India, to the Indian Republic. The question, of course, is where is Kush? Kush is mostly thought by people to be Ethiopia, but that is not correct. The land of Kush is today called Sudan. And we know where Kush is. Kush is not a Jewish thing. If you go to any kind of writings of the ancient world, the kingdom of Kush was a very powerful kingdom. In fact, they are the ones who invented iron. They were the major developers of the ironworks. And in the end, they fell because they lost the fuel to be able to smelt iron, and that was debilitating for them. But the Kushite kingdom, lasted more than 1,000 years. And it was like the Nubian, is also known as Nubians, and we know where their capital city was, Meori. We know where Kush is. Now, Kush today is Sudan, near Eritrea, and Ethiopia is south of that. Ethiopia is south of that. So now, was Ethiopia... east of that. I apologize, east of that. Now, was Ethiopia at some point in a part of the Kushite Empire? Perhaps, but from the ancient documents on Kush, it's the areas around the Blue Nile, the White Nile, bordering the Red Sea, or the Reed Sea. It's not the areas of Ethiopia. It's mistranslated as Ethiopia, but the area is today known as Sudan. And they were, by the way, the rivals of the ancient Egyptians. And there was even a dispute amongst the Egyptians. Where's the border of Egypt end, and where does the border of Kush begin? But that's a subject for another class. But at any rate, so the Gemara is going to say they ruled from Hoidu to Kush. And the Gemara is going to now introduce another dispute of Rav Shmuel, where is Hoidu and where is Kush? So what does that mean? Like, what's really the question? I will add one more little detail, that in the Targum, it says Kush to Arabia, Kush of Arabia, which seems on the southern end of Saudi Arabia, there's a country called Oman, and there's a country called Yemen. So it seems that Oman or Yemen, and there's a number of Mepharshim who maintain that Yemen is actually Kush. That there was two places called Kush. The end of Saudi Arabia, it's not the north, it's southern. I understand what's north of Sudan. But I'm questioning, we're talking about in proximity to India, right? So if you lay out your map over here, if this is Africa, India is over here. And the question is Kush here or is Kush there? But either way, it's not right adjacent. The Arabian Sea is between Oman and Yemen and India. They're divided by the Arabian Sea. The country called Sudan, or which is the probable Kush, is divided by much more than just the Arabian Sea, but a huge amount of land mass as well. Okay, anyway, this is just a little bit of... the Gemara certainly knew much about Africa, because there's many discussions in the Gemara about Africa, many discussions, number one. Number two, the ancient world knew all about Africa, and there are many, many documents of trade, different trade. Africa was a very well-known continent, extremely well-known. If you tell me they didn't know the Americas, I'll agree with you. There's no discussion of the Americas. That's true.
The question here is, what was the word ad, which is not in, it's ad.
Ad means usually up to. No. That nobody's going to argue about that. Ad will certainly be from here to here. But you'll soon see. There's creative ways of understanding this Gemara from the Mepharshim, which we'll soon see. I just wanted to give you that little background. Once you have this little bit of background, with this we can try to approach the Gemara and understand the Gemara. Yes? Is this the same Kush that Moshe went to? In the Medrash meaning of Moshe, when he runs away? Yes. Moshe was in Kush. Moshe was, and that makes sense historically, because at the time of Moshe, the time of the Egyptian kingdom, the next neighboring mighty kingdom was Kush, the Kushites. It actually makes perfect sense. Of course he fled south. And then he ends up in Saudi Arabia, because Midian is Saudi Arabia. He went across the Reed Sea. That's Moshe Rabbeinu's neighborhood. All right, so let's take a look at this Gemara. The Gemara says, Mehoidu vad Kush. What the real question is, what is the Gemara trying to teach us? What is the Megillah trying to tell us? Why does the Megillah try to give us geography? Who cares? Well, the size of the country then would be the probable answer. So we have Rav and Shmuel. Rav and Shmuel are of two opinions. Chad Omar, one says, Hoidu b'soifa olam, India was at one end of the world, if you will. And then we had the other end of the world was until Kush. M'soifa olam v'ad soifa. There's another version of the Gemara, Mitchila Sa'ilam Vad Saifai, from the beginning to the end. In other words, this was their world. Their world is Asia. We do not speak about Europe. Most of the Mepharshim agree that Achashverosh's kingdom did not extend over Europe, which is actually a very small continent. Most of the Mepharshim agree that Achashverosh did not dominate the vast majority of Africa, but that his dominance was mostly in Asia. Asia Minor, Central Asia. We know where Persia is, Iran. That's Central Asia. That's right in the middle of Asia. It's not even Arabian anymore. Right? So his kingdom certainly stretched north into Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, partly into the Ural Mountains. And interestingly, because we know that the Jewish community who lived up in the what do you call them, the Kafkaz Jews, or the mountain Jews, we know that they're actually, their roots are from Persia. They were Persian Jews who migrated there. And they kept a connection with the Persian Jews. So the Pashtos, it's very reasonable to say that what we call the eastern areas of Russia, the eastern areas of Russia were as part of Asia, and that was under Ahasuerus' rule. I don't know how far north he went, but that was under Ahasuerus' rule. And there are many, many customs from that part of the world that look actually very, very Persian, very similar. Similar architecture, similar music, similar words even. There's a lot of similarities. So his empire certainly goes all the way into northern Asia, northeastern Asia. We hear about Kush, so we know for sure that Egypt, for example, and the areas of Sudan and Eritrea, which is a small little place, and probably Ethiopia, or at least a chunk of what's today Ethiopia, was probably also included. That was probably the western border, or the west southwestern border of Ahasuerus's rule. And his dominion then stretched on the south, is stretched out into the east, probably went till the areas of China. Hoidu from India, which borders on China, so or northern China, that area was probably all that massive, which is most of Asia. It's not the Far East. That's what most Mepharshim believe is the likely geography of the Persian Empire, which was the most powerful empire in the world. And it was considered to be world domination, world dominion. I don't know if it included China or not. Possibly it did. It certainly doesn't seem like the Philippines and Japan and these countries are included, you know, all the way west of that. But this was called, you know, controlling the world, the civilized world, if you will, or at least the world of centered around the Middle East that goes further throughout Eurasia. So that's Ahasuerus' country. So why does it say Mahaydu Vat Kush? So we have these two opinions. So Rav is saying that Hoidu is on one extremity, and Kush is on the other extremity. Hoidu, we know, is in the east, and Kush would be on the west, and that would be the whole. In other words, the whole world as was known then, the known world. We're not talking about the Americas. We're not talking about the Mayans and the Aztec and the Incas. We're not talking about the North American tribes. We're not even talking about that. They were totally unknown to the people who lived in Asia. But this whole area of what we would call the cradle of civilization, that area was dominated by Ahasuerus. All right, that opinion actually, it's easy to understand. It makes sense. Like, okay. Then we have Shmuel's opinion. Don't say absolutely so fast. Let's see what Shmuel says. Shmuel says, V'chadamer, Hoidu v'kush gabe hadodi havikaime. Hoidu and Kush are adjacent to one another. Now, if Hoidu and Kush are adjacent to one another, what is the point? You're trying to use terminology that helps you understand how powerful Ahasuerus was, how big his influence and dominion was, that it stretched from one area to the other area. What are you saying? Yeah, the little localized area. One country next to the other. If one country next to the other, what's the big deal? Why would the Megillah want to tell that to you? It's not impressive. So Shmuel says, no, it is. Why? Because his point is like saying, even though that they were relatively close to one another, Kishem Shemolach al Hoidu v'Kush, in the same way, Hoidu v'Kush, he had his iron grip on those countries. They were within a very, very small area, a small controlled area. Kach molach misayf ha'olam ve'ad sayfay. So too, Achashverosh ruled from one end of the world to the other. So it's saying the same thing. The question is how we say it. That's the question. The question is, do we mean to say that he was actually, are we delineating the geographic poles? Or are we saying that in the same way he had control of two areas that are relatively close to one another, and they were under a common dominion, so too Ahasuerus had a massive amount of control. He wasn't an emperor in name. He was really the emperor. His government really controlled all these places. So if you think about it, what is the machlekes? The machlekes, the argument between Rav and Shmuel is, are we talking about the size of Ahasuerus's empire or the quantity? Or are we talking about the quality of his governance? That he had the people in an iron grip. That's the question. On one hand, you would think that Rav's description is much more expansive. Look at this country. From the east all the way to the west. A massive area. But Shmuel will say to you, okay, so it was under sway. So they paid some kind of taxes. They had some kind of homage. If somebody would go and declare himself a king, an army would be dispatched. But otherwise, really, this is, it's who says he had so much control? It doesn't talk about the quality of his ability to police the entire region or the entire world. But according to Shmuel's opinion, we're talking about how powerful Ahasuerus is. And this makes, in some ways, much, much more sense, much more profound, because Ahasuerus sent out letters, and the letters said, you guys get ready, because on this day, and the letter has the seal of Ahasuerus, that they're going to slaughter the Jews on this day. They're going to get slaughtered on this day. Because his word was law. And if a letter arrives with a royal seal, what is written shall be done in the most powerful and swiftest way possible. So this is the discussion between Rav and Shmuel. Now, there are interesting ways of explaining this. Some of the Mefarshim say that does it mean from here to here, or does it mean from here to here? You understand? In other words, as Rav says, from here to here, this whole area. Shmuel says, no, from here all the way around to here.
Which is the same thing now.
Well, it really isn't the same thing at all. According to this way of explaining it, Shmuel also has a much, much bigger perspective on Ahasuerus's power. He sees him as actually controlling the Western Hemisphere also, the whole world. So it's like a little joke they tell, this boy is outside 770 in Eastern Parkway, and a Japanese fellow rolls his window down and he says, how far to Manhattan? Well, this is Brooklyn, Manhattan over the bridge. So he says, the direction you are, about 10,000 miles. So that would be a little joke that explains to you what when they have this delineation. Now, interestingly, if we are to say, like the commentaries who tell us that this refers to the southern edge of Arabia, and the Targum does say it, Kush da Arabia. So that makes sense, because Arabia, Kush, Sudan is definitely not Arabia. Maybe a Muslim country, but it's not Arab. So if you have this notion of Arabia, and Arabia, we know where Arabia, Saudi Arabia, has a very old name. It's millennia old. So if we know that Arabia, and that's southern area of Arabia, so if it's Yemen or Oman, which was only, I think, a modern division, it was really considered that whole strip was one country, is Yemen or Oman, and that area, especially if you take it from Oman, which is in the eastern edge of it, from there to India, is just the Arabian Sea. It's just a little bit of ocean. It's just some ocean between. So really, there's no other land. That's like saying, that's like the two closest countries, because there's no country in between them. Here's your Saudi Arabia. Here's India. Oman is here. The easternmost point of Oman is here. And India is here. He's got it wrapped up. So that would be the opinion of Shmuel. Anyway, that's the pshat in the Gemara, at least as best as I can give you. I don't know a better pshat. I can't really tell you more than that. But that it seems to make some kind of sense. Of course, there's a whole school of thought that afushi machlekes lemafshinan, we don't look for a dispute. And furthermore, how could you have a machlekes in Metzias? Machlekes where something is. Where it is, go find out. But the Gemara is sitting and discussing where it is. If you don't know, and it's important for Torah, dispatch a search group and come back with the answer. Right? So they want to say the answer is the question which Kush we're talking about. those two possible kushas, and that goes into the Arabian thing or not. But of course, the other answer may simply be the way the Maharal says and others, that it depends which direction. It's either from pole A to pole B or going all the way around the globe. It is very difficult to kind of wrap your head around the notion that Ahasuerus controlled the Americas, or the Mayans and the Aztec and the Incas and the Cherokees, because we just have no record of that. So what are the people? The people knew about North America, South America, and then Asia forgot about it until Columbus rediscovered it? Like, okay, not Columbus, whatever. Whoever, the people from the Norse sailors, whoever it was, well, all I'm trying to say is like the Middle East didn't know about it. Asia didn't know about it. It was unknown. They called it the discovery, the New World. So if Ahasuerus dominated it, he dominated it. How could it be he didn't know about it? Very hard to understand. But I want to add one little interesting thing, that it seems from the Megillah that there was Jews living in all 127 provinces. It seems Jews living, because letters were sent to all 127 provinces. And the simple question is, if there was no Jews there, why'd you bother send a letter? There's no Jews. So then there was Jews. That means there was Jews that were living not only in Sudan, but there was Jews living in India, and Jews living in China. All these places had Jews living in them. And if you want to take the opinion that they were going from one end to the other, there was Jews living in North America. I'm not sure how you eat that, but that's... The interesting thing is that we have found Jewish artifacts. There are Chinese Jewish artifacts. And there are Indian Jewish artifacts. There is not a very well-developed community. The community didn't last and eventually imploded because they had no yeshivas and no rabbis and no Torah at some point. But there were Jews living there. And the question is, how did Jews get there? We know of the Chinese Jewish community. It was at one time a very affluent and a very, very powerful Jewish community. We have a Haggadah that's extant, a full Haggadah. And there's a Siddur that's right in Toronto, actually, in the Royal Ontario Museum. There's a Siddur, a Chinese Siddur. And there's a Torah case, a lacquer Torah case. There's no Torah inside, but there's actually, you can see it's a Torah case, Sephardic Torah case. And from the way the Torah case looks, I would say it's very similar to the regular Sephardic Jews. Okay, so we're talking about the time of Ahasuerus, time of the first Beis Hamikdash. During that exile, somehow Jews end up here. The Haggadah, by the way, is in the Second Temple era. So either there was Jews who came to China during that time, or they were in communication. But the halach is like Beshamai over there, which means that the Chinese Haggadah is before Maseches Edyos, when the halacha was decided like Beis Hillel, with regard to Kiddush, Yaknahaz. Over there is Yakhanaz. The order is mixed up. And the order follows Beis Shammai. What that tells you is that the Jews living there, their rabbinic tradition goes back to the immediate post-Second Temple. The later halachas didn't get to them. Anyway, it's all very compelling stuff. The Indian Jews get there from a shipwreck, at least the Bene Israel that we know of today. And there's a whole story about that. And they had very little tradition because everything was lost at sea. And there was generations of Jews who didn't know very much, but they knew they were Jewish and they tried to maintain whatever kind of Jewish life they could. But it seems in the time of Ahasuerus that Jews did live everywhere. Otherwise, ask the simple question. And we're going to go back to that soon. We were always in business, right? Okay, we've got to make a living. So. Okay, so that is the business of Mahodu v'Ad Kush. Now the Gemara continues to develop this idea. And the Gemara says like this. Kayetze bedavar, a similar thing, Ata Omer, we find also with regard to Shlomo HaMelech. That with regard to the dominion of King Solomon, as it's described in detail in the book of Kings, Melachim Aleph, chapters 4 and 5. It's described over there, Ki hu roida b'chol eiver hanohar, that Shlomo HaMelech has dominion on the entire area, the geography that is on the other side of the river, so to speak. B'chol eiver hanohar, mitafsach ve'ad Aza. From Tafsach all the way to Aza. Now where is Tafsach? Tafsach seems that it's like all the way in Iraq, all the way to the Euphrates. So Shlomo HaMelech's kingdom was enormous, all the way from the river Pras, which is described as the border of Eretz Yisrael, it's all Iraq, all the way until Gaza. So it means from the Mediterranean Sea till the Euphrates. That's a giant country. They say we're occupying somebody's country? We have a sliver of Eretz Yisrael. So there's a dispute about this also. Rav Shmuel, Chadam or Tafsach b'Seifa Olam, that for practical purposes, Tafsach is all the way to the east, all the way out to the east, after the Euphrates, all the way out there. And then the Chadam, and the other one says no. That Aza, Gaza is the other end of the world. That's the Mediterranean. That Tafsach is not over there, the other side. Tafsach is actually very close to Aza. But Tafsach, well, Aza, just like he was able to control Tafsach and Aza, which is maybe Gaza and like the, I don't know, Gulf of Aqaba, something right there. So too, Kachmalach HaKol Elim Kulik. Now this, I don't even know. I could not figure out where Tafsach might be, or Aza might be. Cush and Hoidu were easier to figure out than Tafsach and Aza. But the bottom line is, what do we see? That Rav and Shmuel had the same dispute about the way the scriptures described the dominion of King Solomon. Shlomo HaMelech.
Okay.
What's the next words in Gila? Vayihi, bimei Achashverosh. We did that already. Hu, Achashverosh. Hamoylech. We did that. Mehoidu. Vyad Kush. What's the next words? Sheva, right? The Asumo Meyo, Midino, okay, 127 provinces. 127 provinces. Obvious question is, why are we hearing about this? By the way, Mr. Rashi, before we go on, V'achikam, Arkiureide B'chalevet Anor, can maybe Tafsach V'adaza, he is controlling all the Euphrates, the way he controlled Tafsach. Same idea. Those two places close to each other, and the way he has control over these two places close to each other, so too, his dominion stretches. Okay. So what's up with 127 provinces? First of all, why do I care any provinces? What if it was 127, 117, or 97? It's a giant country. What's the difference? What difference to me does it make how many official dialects or official governors? Who cares? What is the Megillah trying to tell me? Okay, whoopee-doo. So, in what way does it enhance Achashverosh's standing? In what way does it deepen the appreciation of the story, and what way does it thicken the plot, and what way does it make it more dramatic?
It's just the power of his rule that,
listen, we live in Canada. Canada is from sea to shining sea. It's a pasuk from Till. Minor ad nor medav siyaretz. Okay. One second. How many people other than Canadians, or maybe I should rephrase the question, how many Canadians know how many provinces there are in Canada?
It's actually dropped. No, so the beginning of the year.
You just mentioned Canada, so it could be the same way as with Canada. We had Upper Canada and Lower Canada, Quebec and Ontario, and then we started moving that way, and we increased the number, and we increased the number.
Not only it could be, what you're saying is very good, because you can see Achashverosh's empire grows. You're right. Just like Upper Canada, Lower Canada, you're right. Achashverosh's. But here's my point. Whether there's 13 provinces in Canada, or there is 97 provinces in Canada, is totally irrelevant. The average person knows Canada is a big country. That's what they know. It's a big country. They don't know, most people do not know, we have more polar bears than people. That most people do not know that. And most people do not know that there are not even just barely 30 million people living in a country that has a greater landmass than the United States of America. Huh? 36 million? Okay, I'll stand corrected. See? I'm not even a good Canadian. Okay. So the 36 million. 36 million people living in a country. The United States has almost 300 million people living in an area that's smaller than Canada's 36 or 35 million people.
300 million people in the United States. Most of them don't know where Canada is.
That's not the point. The point is, America has become famous for its 50 states. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if somebody knows America has 50 states or as a certain guy campaigning for the presidency called it 57 states. I never figured that one out. How a guy can run for president and think the 57 states. I don't know. I grew up in America. I never, by mistake, said 57.
Well, he's got
I don't know. I don't know how it works. Who said it? Obama. He said, I've been to 57 states. I've seen all 57 states.
He was together with Palin watching the airplane state.
I don't. I'm just saying. Okay, whatever. Be that as it may, whether the United States is 50 states or 49 states or 52 states, whether you want to call Puerto Rico a state, doesn't make a difference. The United States of America is United States. So you want to say Achashverosh had a massive empire? You said it, Mehoidu V'Adkush. That is the premise. The premise is that every word of the scripture, every word of our Jewish apocrypha is nevuah, it's Torah, it has a lesson to teach us. There is nothing that is kind of just this. Whatever. 127. If it says 127, it has to have a message. It doesn't necessarily have to have a moral message. It doesn't have an ethical message. It has that also, by the way. We'll soon see. But the first thing we have to ask, what is this literal message? What's being conveyed to us? So just saying, you said a very big country. Why do you have to say 127? But the Gemara asks a different question. The Gemara is also going to be alluding to the notion that we have an interesting scale, that when we talk about this, you're going to see like the scale is, it's a falling scale. Pardon me, a rising scale. Okay, we're going to, Amar Rav Chisda. Rav Chisda says, do you know why it's written in this fashion? By the way, the Mefarshim say that the question is, this is what the Mefarshim, the question is, why it says Sheva, and then Esrim, and then Meah. Usually we say 127. Nobody says 720, 100.
Except in Arabic, it's always the units first.
That's very nice. I don't speak Arabic, but this is Hebrew. So what should it say? Meah Esrim v'Sheva. Why does it say Sheva v'Esrim v'Meah? It seems to me you could expand this question to ask what is going on over here altogether. What is the deeper message here? What is the Megillah trying to tell me? But at any rate, hold that thought. Very good. You remembered Sarah? Hold the thought. We're going to get there. Don't go anywhere. But let's first figure out what this Meyav Esrim Meyav is. Amr Rav Chizda says, Ami's right. Upper Canada, Lower Canada, expansion. Mitchila Malach al Sheva. He started out small, a small little emperor, a small little king. He got control of seven countries. Ulubasayf Malach al Esr. Then in the end, his influence continued to grow. And he began to conquer countries. And then he was not ruler of seven, but ruler of 20. And then Ulubasayf Malach al Meya. And in the end, he ruled 100 countries. So actually, it's not 127 countries. 127 Sheva, the Esrim, Umeya. We just got a snapshot of this man's psyche. This is a megalomaniac who wanted to control the world. He didn't fall into an empire. He didn't fall into a throne and inherit something. He built this empire. He started off with a very small area. We said he bought it off with his money, or he was very talented, very articulate, very capable, very influential, very dynamic, very charismatic. Whatever his talents were, whether it was more his money or more his talents, he managed to propel himself to the front of the class, and he became the ruler of a small country with seven provinces. But that wasn't good for him. This megalomaniac had to build. He had to have a bigger country. Why? You have a bigger palace? What do you need a bigger country for? He needed a bigger country. And then he had to... The Einschluss, more land, bigger, more prominent, more powerful. And in the end, he controlled 100 countries, were hammered together under the banner of his empire. So now we know why it's Sheva and Esrim and Meah. So you think, what do I care if it's 127? And if it was 126, the story would be different? And if it was 117, the story wouldn't be as profound? The answer is, no. We just conveyed to you, we did the Megillah in three words, just gave you a picture of who Achashverosh was. That's very important. Because if you take the wrong-headed approach, it was just a dumbbell, then you have a wrong understanding of the story. He was nobody's fool. Extremely capable. One of the most capable politicians / monarchs probably ever to walk the face of the earth. That's who he was. In the end, he ends up with 100. The Gemara says, really? Really, are you so sure that this kind of works? That you could tell me that because it says 7, and then it says 20, and then it says 100, that actually is telling you a message that first he started off at 7, and then he expanded, and he went to 100? Well, what about Sarei Menu? Elamata v'shnei, apari, we're not going to go with that, Sarei Menu. Ma'at, the Gemara says, v'shnei chai Amram, the numbers, when the Torah speaks about the numbers of Amram's life, it says Sheva, and then it says Shloishim, and then it says Meya. My Dorash Debay, what are you going to expound over there? So why does it say, by the way, sorry, Imenu Drusha Drasha. Bas Sheva, Bas Esrim, Bas Esrim, Bas Kuf. There is a Drasha. I don't want to go into that. There's a Drasha about sorry, Imenu. We'll talk about that soon. So the Gemara doesn't bring down the question of sorry, Imenu, because we know what the Drasha, what sorry, Imenu is. The Gemara's question is, What about Amram? If it's true that every time the Torah uses a sliding, a rising scale, first Sheva, and then the first is the single digits, and then the double digits, and the triple digits, that there is a message being conveyed, what would you say then when the Torah tells us about the years of Amram? What, first he lived 7 years, then he died, then he lived 30 years, then he died, then he lived 100 years. What's up, shot? So the Gemara says, Shaini Hocha, there's no comparison. This is different. The Kroya Seirahi. Because this is an additional and seemingly unnecessary verse. Very, very big difference. In other words, it's unnecessary. What did you want to convey with 127? That he had a big country? You already conveyed that. You said that he ruled from here to here. Now, why do I care how many different provinces were from here to here? Once you described his kingdom as being massive, so it doesn't make a difference how many provinces there are. How many countries was the former Soviet Union? We got two answers. Two smart people. Felix says 15, and then Bill says 21. And I'm going to tell you a little secret. I don't know which one of you is right, or if somehow both of you are right. It makes no difference to me. The formidable nature of the Soviet Union was formidable to me as a child growing up in the United States and listening to Ronald Reagan's rhetoric, whether it was 20 countries or 17 countries or 10 countries. It was the Soviet Union. Sovietskaya Union was a scary place. A lot of countries, very powerful. That's all. It doesn't make a difference how many countries the Soviet Union swallowed up.
Actually, it does. If you are dealing even with a huge country with a homogeneous population, you know how to rule this type of people. If you are dealing with 127, 150 completely different nationalities, completely different setup, completely different mentality, much more difficult, and you have to have really an iron grip on each one. So they have to build a mechanism which will enable you a hostile leader.
Okay. So that's an excellent point, Felix. It's an excellent point, and I'm actually going to talk about that point soon from a different perspective. It's an excellent point. But we could, let me just reiterate your point to make sure I understand what you're saying. You're saying that to be able to have an empire of 127 distinct cultures and languages and countries, and to be able to hold 127 countries, is something unbelievable. It's unbelievable, because the more color, the more change, the more anthropology is different, the more difficult it is for them to get together under a single banner. So we're talking about then the real charisma and power of Achashverosh. But I will argue, Felix, that was already stated when we said Mahidavad Kush, that he had control of this whole massive country, just like the two places that were right next to, just like Oman in other words, let me concede that you have answered my first question. This is my question only, so the question I made out of it is why we have to get 127. You have given a very profound answer as to why the number of 127 would actually be a powerful thought, would be a message in and of itself. But what your question does not answer is why it says it on the sliding scale. I'll tell you what you did answer for me. I thought I had a very good question. I thought the thrust of the Gemara is, who cares 127? But the Mefarshim say no. The thrust was Sheva ve'esrim u'meya. And I didn't know why the Mefarshim said that. Why didn't they say what I'm saying? Now I know why. Because I'm wrong. You're right. You're absolutely right. What you're saying makes perfect sense. And I should have thought of this, because you're soon going to see, I'm going to share with you a teaching of the Rebbe that is similar. Is very similar to this. Only on the other side.
There's also the point.
On the other side.
The more they're divided, the easier it is to rule.
Generally speaking, all empires try to impose a single language. The Soviet Union forced everybody to speak Russian. They forced everybody to try to follow a certain... And the moment Perestroika came and the Soviet Union fell, all of a sudden patriotism flared. The Estonian was an Estonian, and the Latvian was a Latvian, and nobody wanted to be under the common shackles of a government again. So anyway, the question, let's say, I'll concede to you on that point, the question still remains though, what's with the Sheva, what's with the Esrim, and what's with the Mea, right? So the Gemara says, over here, just to convey that it was a very, very large country, we had Mahidavad Kush. Or Felix, maybe just to say that there was 127 countries, we could have said, Mea, Esrim, Sheva. if you wanted to make the point that you're making of being so capable of dominating people from different backgrounds. But we still don't have an answer to why it says Me'a ve'estim v'sheva. And since we already know Mahidu ve'et Kush is very, very large, and since that idea got conveyed already, so whether it's 126 or 127, we already know that it was a very large area, and we know that the anthropology and civilizations of those areas are very, very different, that the Nubian people and the Indian people are not one and the same, with very different cultures. So we should understand already this. And the Torah emphasizes this number. What's the reason for it? So the Gemara answers, the Gemara says, that's why here we would say there would have to be a lesson that's being taught. Whereas with the years of Amram, you had to say how old he was. It's not an extra verse. It's not entirely extraneous, at least. This over here, even if it's not entirely extraneous, it's somewhat extraneous. But with Amram, there's nothing extraneous. He died, so we tell him, find out how old he was. That's all. So the Gemara concludes now by saying, here it's a Kroya Seda. Michti, let me see. Ksiv Mehedu V'ad Kush. And Mehedu V'ad Kush, then it says, Sheva V'esr Mehu Medina. Lomali, Shema Mino. From here I understand, L'drasha, that there is another teaching, there's something else being conveyed to me. And that's why the Gemara says, this talks about Ahasuerus's ruthless ambition. Kept building. Now, since we all talked about Esther, and since we talked about Sarah Yemenu, and we mentioned that I'm 127, but Eshkoyach, very nice that everybody brought that up. And since Felix talked about the idea of multiculturalism and the difficulties of trying to find full common ground, I am going to share with you a teaching of the Rebbe, which is based on a Medrash Tilim, and it's also found in a number of different places. The same Medrash found in a number of places that says, how did Esther manage to be queen over 127 different countries? Ma rasa Esther shetim lach al sheva ve'esr me'a medina. Says the Medrash, Ella, tovay Esther should come. Shahisa Bas Bita Shosara, she is a descendant of Sarai Menu. Many, many generations. By my calculation, somewhere between 30 and 35 generations later, maybe even more, maybe 37 generations. Shahisa Kuf Chav Zayin, that Sarai Menu lived for 127 years. So Esther, who's a great granddaughter of Sarai Menu, lives 120 years. Timlecha Kuf Chav Zayin Medinas. That's the Medrash says. And this medrash, like many medrashim, on the surface seems totally ridiculous. If Sarai Imenu lived for 127 years, and that's why there should be some kind of Jewish dominion, so then the kingdom of Israel should have been 127 countries. Shlomo HaMelech should rule the 127 countries. But what do you have to ask the 35 generations later that she wasn't even under the guise of a Jewish banner. She was consort to a Persian king who could lope her head off at any moment, and she's terrified even to ask him for something. Like, what's the connection? And anyway, what's the connection? Just like, he's like, you play alphabet soup over here, 127, here 127, there, oh, there must be a connection. What does Sarai Imenu's years have to do with Esther's dominion, Esther's royal position? So the Rebbe says, a gewaltige thing. What is the message of 127 years? What does Rashi tell us? He says that Sarai Imenu's years were kulan shavin l'toiva. They're all equally good. They're all equally good. She's a barren woman, doesn't have children. And at some point, she was abducted and kept prisoner in Mitzrayim, which was like for a few months. And she dealt with the angst of having Hagar becoming disrespectful, and then Yishma, I mean, she's tzaras, a lot of tzaras. Sarai didn't have an easy life. Kulam shavu l'toiva? How could you say that? It doesn't make any sense even. And does anybody's life, anybody live a perfect, charmed life? Does anybody live a life where it doesn't have a tough day? No such thing. So what's the pshat? The pshat of kulam shavu l'toiva does not mean that all of Sarai Imenu's days were equally wonderful materially. It means that despite the fact that Sarai Imenu had highs and lows, she always maintained her composure. She always maintained her faith. And she always maintained her balance. And she always maintained her focus. And she was not phased by challenges. And that's unbelievable. Because we all get phased and we flip out and we lose it. And we're not functioning fully. so they may function at the highest level of spiritual acuity, regardless of the realities that surround her. It's an incredible concept. The Rebbe says, now let's go back to the story of Purim. The word gets out. Mordechai makes sure to convey the word. They're here to get us. It's over. What was the Jewish response? They came together with Mesiras Nefesh. But the emphasis is they came together. Vayikohalu. From the term hakel, kehila. They came together. Now, lots of different Jews sitting around this table. Some of us come from different places. Some of us come out of different ethnicities. This one makes a chalant that's called a soupy chalant. And this one's chalant is a dry chalant. And this one's chalant has rice. And that one's chalant is called dafina. And the other one's chalant is called couscous. And this one davens with this nusach, and that one davens with that nusach. You ever meet more people with fewer people with more ideas than Jews? We are famous for this, that the three Jews and nine opinions. We're famous for this. There's no country in the world that has such a small population with so many political parties. No country in the world. There's no such thing. Canada has 36 million people. They barely have three parties. Fourth party, barely, this is for five parties if you stretch your imagination.
But in Israel, only two people or three parties.
That's, now we're talking. Israel's got like 40 parties. So, but the Jewish people are so different. And furthermore, Jewish people, in every place that they have lived, they have adopted certain local customs and elevated them. They've made it a part of the Jewish repertoire. The Hungarian Jewish customs, Hungarian menhagim, are not the same as Russian menhagim, and Polish menhagim are not the same as Lithuanian menhagim, and they are certainly not the same as Moroccan menhagim, and Moroccan are not the same as the Syrian, and the Iraqi is not the Egyptian. And everybody is different. And this culture has this kind of music, and the other one has that kind of music, and they sing Adon Olam this way, and the other ones don't sing Adon Olam, and the other ones sing Adon Olam in three ways. Now here we have Jews living in 127 provinces. They were not even Facebook friends. They didn't have a way to communicate. It's already 70 years of Gaulah, so we know that in the course of these 70 years, the Jewish people experienced mass assimilation. How did they come together like this? How is it possible that they came together? How is it possible that they actually managed to get it together? It makes no sense. It should not have been. This is something they should not have been able to get together. Ah, but guess what, my friends? Despite the fact that we have different skin color and sing different songs and eat different chalant, we all have the pintel yid. And the pintel yid is equal. And once the pintel of the dot of Jewishness, the nuclear essence of our neshama, was revealed, game over. Everything changed. We were all on the same page. Just like Sarah Imenu, who lived with her pintaliyad. Just like Sarah Imenu, says the Rebbe, who was able to marshal the forces of her neshama to transcend the vicissitudes of the different times that she was in and different realities that she experienced. She was able to go past that. So too, the Jewish people living in 127 provinces, when the call came, they were able to forget the differences and able to be on the same page and able to be totally devoted to our HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And then now we understand why Esther is able to be king over 127 provinces or countries, and where there is a commonality between the story of Sarah and the story of Esther. But I would say, Felix, you gave a very interesting addition to this whole thing, the interesting new approach, where this furthermore tells us about the ambition and the power of Ahasuerus, a man who could hammer together so many countries, so many realities, and he managed to hold them together. And the empire didn't collapse. He held it together for a very long time. In fact, his son rules after him. And we don't hear about disintegration of the empire so fast. So at any rate, now we understand, we have gotten a little further than Megillah. Now we're a few words ahead. We learned about Hamoylech. We did Rabbi Hoidu Vat Kush. And we did Sheva Ve'esim Omeya Medina.